Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 252. It is January 19th, 1879, and we are standing alongside Lord Chelmsford at the British camp at Rorke's Drift. Nearby is Henry Francis Finn, Jr. Chelmsford had grown frustrated by the rain, which had slowed the crossing of the Imzinyati at Rorke's Drift. He had also been frustrated by Henry Francis Finn, Jr., who had been negotiating with Zulu chiefs without his permission. Finn's father, Henry Francis Sr., was the first English trader in Natal and had spent a lot of time with King Shaka. The Finns were all fluent in Zulu and extremely informed when it came to Zulu matters, and Finn Jr. was working as the magistrate of a Msinga region in Natal. Chelmsford was determined to have Finn permanently attached to his staff, partly to keep an eye on him and partly to consult with the experienced colonials seeking to test his tactics. On the 16th of January, Chelmsford had written to Finn's boss, Natal's Lieutenant Governor Sir Henry Bulwer, asking Finn be reassigned. On reflection, Chelmsford decided he wasn't going to wait for Bulwer and summarily ordered Finn to Rorke's Drift anyway. So Finn duly arrived at the drift on the 19th, the same time as Captain George Shepston, son of Theophilus. George was Colonel Durnford's staff officer. Column 3, he said, had become bogged down in the muddy trails on the high ground. But early on the morning of the 20th, Durnford was to begin to roll forward once more towards Isandlwana and his destiny. Meanwhile, Lord Chelmsford was instituting his new plan of action, which he had outlined to Governor Sir Bartle Frere. Instead of leading his column, or to be completely accurate, Lieutenant Colonel Glynn's column, eastwards in a direct route to Isiphesi and then on to Tshwayo Kampandi's home of Undini, he was going to concentrate his attention towards the Malakata and the Hlazakazi Hills. These rise between Isandlwana Plain and the Mangeni Valley to the southeast. It made sense because Finn Jr. had told him that the Zulu plan was to descend the Mangeni Heights and attack No. 3 column in the rear, so he needed to secure his invading column's right or southern flank. At 9 a.m. on the 20th of January, and with Finn at his side, Chelmsford rode east from Rorke's Drift and then paused at Isandlwana for breakfast. A civilized affair, cold meats, strong hot tea. He wanted to confront Manchana Kamondisa, Amakungubene chief, who had told Finn he was considering joining the British, which was strange because prior to this, Manchana was one of the chiefs believed to have been strongly in favour of a war against the British. By the time Chelmsford's men moved forward on the 20th, the Zulu population had largely abandoned the Imzinyati River Valley opposite Rorke's Drift. So a great swathe of the country around Isandlwana lay empty. The homesteads of the Amakungubeni deserted and forlorn, with a few bands of Zulu warriors hiding out in the hills, watching and waiting. The emptiness of the landscape troubled Chelmsford and the colonials. 9 days after crossing the border and destroying Sehayo's village at Kwasokhetle on the 12th, he was confident that his demonstration of force had unnerved the Zulu Empire. On the left of his line of advance lay the territory of Nkunu Nkosi Manchana Ka Sichakuza, not to be confused with Manchana Ka Mondisa of the Amakungubeni. There was some confusion about Manchana Ka Sichakuza's position. He was an officer in the Indaba Kawombi Ibuto and commanded about 800 warriors. This was a formidable opponent. On the other hand, Finn and British sources had suggested that Manchana's personal relationship with the king was poor. He was a rich chief and wanted good relations with the English. Bad intelligence sows havoc because Ka Sichakuza's son Mizu was married to one of Tshwayo's sisters. Would he really go behind Tshwayo's back and disrupt the strong royal connection? You can imagine the cloud of uncertainty because the names of both chiefs were the same. Manchana Kamundisi was even more difficult to fathom. Kamundisi's Sitoli lay to Chelmsford's right front, their territory in the broken country towards the forests of Kudeni. Chelmsford solved the nomenclature riddle by just lumping them together, calling them the two Machanas, as if they were the two Ronnies. The Shepston family had tangled with Manchana Kamundisi for decades, and old man Theophilus and his son George had briefed Chelmsford saying Kamundisi was a die-hard opponent of European interests. As historian Ian Knight points out, it says much for the self-delusion of British military and colonial officials in southern Africa that Chelmsford seriously considered the second option might be a viable one, that they were friends. "We saw a few women running away with bundles on their heads," Chelmsford said afterwards. "But otherwise, the country was deserted. Some natives say the inhabitants have gone to the king. Others say they are in the Kudeni bush." With these conflicting thoughts raging in his mind, the patrol finished breakfast and the riding party made its way across the summit of the Mangeni until Hlazakazi came to an abrupt end at the incredible Mangeni Gorge. It's a dramatic and narrow crevice where a stream of water drops over a sheer cliff, falling 100 metres into a deep green pool before winding onwards between steep, high banks hugging the foot of the ridge. Colonel Craddock, who we've met already, Chelmsford's aide-de-camp, promptly pulled out his paintbrushes as he looked out over the remarkably beautiful countryside. From where they were, range after range of hills disappeared into the blue haze of the Biggesberg. Below, finally, they saw people, as tiny as ants, herding cattle. There was no sign of the party of warriors that Hamilton Brown had seen the day before. And as Krellick clicked and tutted, reproducing the scene in swirls of paint, Manchana Kamondisi was conferring with commanders of the main Zulu army, 24,000 strong, which was only 12 kilometres away behind Isipesi Hill. The reconnaissance party looked further east, where Undini lay, and where Chelmsford had been told the Zulu army had only begun to march on the 19th of January. This massive force had actually begun to move on the 17th, and they were at hand, little did the British know. Put yourself in the boots of these soldiers from both sides. Inshingwayo Kamholi led one of the columns because the Zulu army had split up as it moved, but both columns remained in sight of each other. Mavume Ngwanakantuli led the other and was the junior of the two leaders, although he was in cause of the powerful Itulwana Ibuto. Remember too that Gichwayo's trusted eyes and ears in Tuswa Kanhlaka was watching the commanders and was to report on their performance to his king. Finn had predicted that the Zulu army would swing around the foot of the Hlazakazi and Malakata mountains, outflank the British on their right, and fall on Rorke's Drift behind Chelmsford. If that was the case, the chance of a quick British victory was slim indeed. The other option was they could skirt Chelmsford's left, to the north, in other words, and cross the Mangeni Valley higher up, then advance down on Isandlwana Plain. The British patrols sat on the heights, staring down on the route of these two options for 2 hours. Eventually, Chelmsford ordered the group to mount their horses and descend towards Mangeni Valley, taking an easy route they'd seen above the falls and heading for the foot of a distinctive conical hill called Mduchana. Unknowingly, they were riding closer to the Zulu army. The level ground above the waterfall was an excellent spot, said Chelmsford, for his next camp. From here, he could command the road down into the Kudeni Badlands and keep an eye on his left, the north, at the same time. Reading all of these excursions, I must say as a war veteran, it's extraordinary for a commanding officer to ride off deep into hostile territory unprotected. And Chelmsford had done this twice now, if you recall last episode. He'd managed to survive both outings, but members of his group, Lieutenants Neville Coggle and Teignmouth Melville, decided they'd try and chase down chickens they saw at a deserted Zulu kraal. Coghill fell off his horse and dislocated his kneecap. His colleagues relocated it for him by pulling on his boot, and it clicked back into place. Extremely painful, and he was remounted, suffering agonies. "I put my knee out," he wrote in a letter discovered in the blood-soaked tent he shared with Captain Hallam Parr. The story of Coggle and Melville does not end there, but in a few days it will, with one going on to win the Victoria Cross posthumously for his courage. Behind the Isipesi Mountain, 24,000 Zulu troops camped on the evening of the 20th of January, 1879. The warriors had marched at a leisurely pace westwards towards the British, saving up their energy for the actual day of battle, whatever day that was. They did not march alone. Some of the women remained and would be with the column on the day of battle. For every three warriors, there was an Udibi boy, a lad in his early teens, loaded down with as much paraphernalia as the haughty warriors could expect him to stagger along with: a cooking pot, sleeping mats, dismantled spare shields, and sometimes he was given the honor of carrying the warrior's spears. Usually, these boys carried a smaller spear of their own, and those who did so were going to have an unexpected opportunity to wash their blades in the blood of the soldiers dressed in red, and the blood of their kin serving with the British, the Natal native contingent. The Zulu sent out mounted scouts, and behind them point groups of 200 to 400 warriors patrolled fully armed in front of the bulk of the advancing columns. These advanced warriors did not move with the Udibi boys. They were highly mobile and carried only their spears and shields. The Zulu had a carefully managed system when it came to a march, and the main role for these few hundred soldiers was to draw a foe away from the main army to maintain surprise. But the other role was to draw the enemy into a concealed area like a koppie or a ravine, then ambush them. 20th of January was the fourth day of marching, and now all the warriors were conscious they were drawing within striking distance of the British. They slowed down to a crawl, and that night set up camp in the shadow of Isipesi. Some of the warriors crawled up the north face of the mountain at dusk and peered out west into the setting sun, and there, before them, the white bell tents of Chelmsford's column against the black backdrop of Isandlwana Hill. It was 16 kilometres away. Nchingwayo sat with Mkunu Inkosi Manchana Ka Sichakuza, who was not entirely trusted, as you heard. Mpande had provided him with sanctuary after he'd fought with Shepston, but hunkered after Natal. He called Henry Francis Finn Jr. his friend, but Nchingwayo didn't have much choice if indeed Ka Sichakuza was playing a double game. There was a lot of broken ground between himself and the British, and he needed Machana's knowledge of the local terrain. At dusk, Chelmsford's riding party returned to Isandlwana. The commander surveyed the neat rows of tents, but he made no comment about the fact there were no defensive positions set up. The wagons were in rows instead of in a laager. The camp was spread out like an English village in the twilight of Africa. Earlier, Inspector George Mansell had reached the neck of Isandlwana after Chelmsford's party had enjoyed their breakfast at the historical hill, and Mansell was going to be involved in a feisty discussion about the location of the camp. He was commanding officer of the Natal Mounted Police Force of around 200 men. The NMP was formed in 1873 following the Langalibalele Rebellion. Their purpose? Basically, they copied the idea of a Boer commando. Primary role: maintain order, patrol extensive borders, and act as a paramilitary force supporting the British Army when necessary. They were all excellent riders and crack shots, known for their endurance and mobility. The men dismounted at Isandlwana, and Mansell was approached by Major Clary, Lieutenant Colonel Glynn's aide-de-camp, who asked for assistance in selecting a place to pitch the tents. They rode towards the eastern slopes of Isandlwana, where the ground began to level with the plain, and Clary suddenly remarked, "I think this will do," and asked Mansell what he thought. Mansell replied that, "I don't like it one bit," and pointed out that the campsite was commanded by a steep, sharp hill called Black's Koppie, less than 300 metres away, and also commanded by the slope of Isandlwana itself. The British, like the Boers, preferred a site that had a clear view of attacking warriors, a field of fire. This was not an ideal field of fire. Clary appeared irritated and replied, "No, this will do," and ordered Mansell to post cavalry outposts in front of the camp. These are known as vedettes, normally two or three mounted men. At about 10 a.m., Mansell rode off with his troopers towards the Nauru Ridge, which rises from Isandlwana to the north, and at about a kilometre from the campsite, he placed a series of vedettes at the highest points along the top of the range. Their silhouettes could be seen clearly from the camp, and if the enemy was sighted, they were to circle their horses round and round quickly, then retreat towards Isandlwana. Mansell headed to the other side of Isandlwana, away from the camp, and placed another vedette there. Later, when the bulk of the force arrived, Henry Francis Finn Jr. was also asked about the campsite, and he agreed it was a poor choice. He pointed to the flat open ground 4 kilometres away as a more suitable place with a vast field of fire. Clary ignored him as well. So, by the evening of the 20th, as the warriors shielded their eyes from the setting sun and watched unseen from the Isipesi Hills. And Inchinguayo grilled Manchana Kastichakuza. Chelmsford sat in his tent, formulating a new plan of action. After the day's ride, he decided that the whole Malakata and Sazakazi range needed one more scouting, thoroughly testing if any Zulu army lay within. Hamilton Brown's skirmish with a large group of warriors on the 19th was on his mind. The soldiers he selected for this job were the colonials and the black native contingent troops because they were the most mobile. Some detachments of the NNC would be left at camp as pickets, but the rest would be sent on a long sweep around and across the hills starting at dawn on the 21st of January. If you remember the earlier podcasts, the Mounted Police of Carboniers, as they were also known, had been extremely angry when they were told they'd be led by George Mansell, preferring Major Dartnell, their commanding officer. But before the invasion of Zululand, Chelmsford had inserted Mansell as his choice, then promoted Dartnell to his staff. After a few days of reality in Zululand, Chelmsford realized that the major was best placed to lead the Carboniers and the Natal native contingent, so he ordered Dartnell to take command of the NNC and the Carboniers and to move out at daybreak on the 21st. The bitterness between Chelmsford's men and those of Lieutenant Colonel Glynn only increased because Glynn had not been told about this plan. In the Carboniers' camp, Fred Simons would recall later that members of Tent No. 3, whose names were Sergeant Methley and Troopers Davis, Green, McElroy, Slatter, Sibthorpe and myself, sat down in cheerful mood to a good dinner provided by our genial quartermaster London, little dreaming that we should never mess together again. The camp settled in for the night, but in truth, there was very little sleep to be had. Major Dartnell woke his men at midnight and paraded the Carboniers on their steeds. He warned the men they were embarking on an extremely dangerous mission and that those who wanted to go should volunteer. Nearly all of them did, only one or two slinking back in fear. The irony was, it would be the fearful few who would pay with their lives. The Carboniers were issued with one day's rations, 4 biscuits for each man, a large tin of salmon between 2. Only those with the strongest horses were selected. The rest, under Lieutenant Scott, 29 in all, were left in camp for vedette duty. Watching all of this was regular soldier Lieutenant Charlie Pope of the 2nd and 24th, who decried his bad luck. He wasn't going along on the sweep. Little did he know what awaited him through the day of the 21st of January. Survivors reported later that a strange sense of foreboding appeared to hang over the camp, despite the cheery atmosphere at dinner. For journalist Norris Newman, the only international reporter at hand, the news confirmed the wisdom of his decision to attach himself to the Natal native contingent, and he went to bed dreaming of further scoops. He was destined not to be disappointed. Later he would write, "From this time, our troubles began." Troubles? That's an understatement. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about various episodes. You can email me from there and sign up for my little newsletter. Until we meet again, salagatli.